I'm Robert Harrison for Entitled Opinions, and we're coming to you from the Elysian Fields of KZSU. Our topic today is artificial intelligence and what it says about who we are and who we are not. The guest who joins me in the studio has just finished a book called An Artificial History of Natural Intelligence, due out later this year. Those of you who've heard our previous shows on this topic know that I, for one, believe that machine learning is a world historical event that calls for thinking. My guest is someone who responds to that call. He thinks beyond the technical and sociological aspects of AI and asks how its technology relates to, indeed, how it arises from within our human way of being. That human way of being is through and through historical. But what exactly does that mean? And what does machine learning have to do with being historical? What, for that matter, does it have to do with what Heidegger called the history of being? Stay tuned, friends, an existential analytic of AI coming up. My guest is David Bates, a professor in the Department of Rhetoric at UC Berkeley, whose most recent work deals with the intersections between technology, science, and the history of human cognition. In his aforementioned new book to be published by the University of Chicago Press this spring, David Bates makes a compelling case for how the human mind is not simply a product of the brain, but is instead the site of operations for several different systems, biological, sociopolitical, and technical, among others. These systems, which are always entangled in the human condition, often conflict with one another, even as they work together to maintain the cohesion of social groups and the survival of biological individuals. Here's a quote to ponder. "What we mean by the mind is the continuing and always failing attempt to bring unity to the multiple systems in play. As such, the mind is not itself a unity with given norms and therefore an object of scientific study, but instead an evolving contingent effort to capture the varying logics of survival that stem from our biological, sociopolitical, and technical systems. The mind is both defined by these systems and is resolutely not these systems." With that, let's hear directly from the author of that quote, David Bates. Welcome to Entitled Opinions. I'm glad you could join us today.
It's great to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
And that quote I read, a rather heavy quote, comes from the end of your book, and there's a lot to unpack in that. But I'm particularly interested in the word failing in that parenthesis, where you say that the human mind is the continuing and always failing attempt to bring unity to the multiple systems in play. And in a culture, an American culture that glorifies winning, I think it's very interesting to suggest that being human is in some fundamental respect an ongoing failure to achieve an ultimate coherence of being. You refer often to the concept of error in your book and distinguish it from, let's say, existential errancy. So maybe we could begin with how you understand this open-ended, kind of self-transcending errancy of the human condition.
Sure. I think that's a great place to start. Maybe to begin with a metaphor that was very popular back in the 18th century, which is to think about metaphorically the field of knowledge as a kind of territory. So there's parts of the territory that are well known, that are mapped out, these sort of like roads and systems of orientation. We can make mistakes sometimes within that orientation. We might go down the wrong road. We might go the wrong direction. There may be neighborhoods that we don't know very well, and we might make a mistake. But fundamentally, the area is known and can be measured. The error can be measured against the truth of the map. When I think about errancy, it's when we go off the map and we're in a new territory, a territory that doesn't offer any clear indication of the path. And that's where human beings seem to be different kinds of creatures than animals. We seem to be called to this open space and capable of leaving the known territory and seeking insight in this new territory.
Yeah, so we're thrown into the unfamiliar.
Exactly.
And perhaps we're always in the realm of the unfamiliar, but we have strategies by which we try to forget that we're in the midst of the strange and we live within our everyday kind of familiar worlds.
I think that's a really important point, is that it's not that we really have a known normal and solid reality that we then stray from to discover a new world. The world that is supposedly so familiar to us is actually very mysterious and highly contingent and actually constantly in motion as well.
Yeah, for sure. That reminds me really of the Ode on Man, in the famous Ode on Man in Sophocles' Antigone, where and heavily commented by Heidegger, among others, about there is much that is strange, but nothing stranger than Anthropos. He's thrown into the strange, and that he dares to be violent in the midst of the overwhelming and the overpowering, and that there's something in human nature that is just wrenched out of any home kind of context, and that we are errant in that sense, and that sometimes we even over-embrace that errancy, and we venture onto the winter storm seas, and we try to bring the earth under our control and so forth.
Exactly.
So our technology, it seems to be suggested, even in that ancient ode, that all the ingenious devices and technologies by which we domesticate animals, trap birds, sail the seas, is somehow related to this strangeness of the human.
I think that's right, is that one of the things that we can say about the human is that we break from our nature. That if nature was the home or is the home for an animal form of existence, is that what defines the human is that break from nature, the leaving of the home of the natural world, and we construct our own world. And that's why we are historical creatures. There's a form of history in Darwinian evolution, but it's not what we really mean by history in the human sense of the word. For the human, the history is the fact that it is not necessary. The form of life that we take on is one that is not determined by our biology, but can be very open. And that's the recognition, as you said, of this kind of worldlessness that is at the heart of even an established form of life that we have on this earth.
So I gather from what I've read of your book that you do believe that it's because of we are wrenched out of a natural environmental context like animals maybe inhabit, that we construct our worlds through the tools that we devise, and that therefore technology in its primitive beginnings, but all the way up to, you know, the contemporary ChatGPT things, that technology is our way of, what word should I use, negotiating, living with, managing, being thrown outside of ourselves?
Well, that's a good way to put it. I think that rather than think of the human as something that achieves a certain level of intelligence and then invents tools as a kind of supplement to their natural life, we have to think of the human as wrenching themselves out of nature through the use of tools. But that means that we have this sort of strange condition. We're at one time forming lives, forming social groups that are supported by technologies, as you said, ways of gathering food, processing food, establishing territories, and so on. We're making a home through technology, but technology was always a wrenching out of nature and therefore can never bring us back to that sort of stability. So what we have at the same time is this constant capacity for being wrenched out of the lives that we're constructing. And I think that technology is capable of doing that through its own evolution. And that's what we see, as you say, from the beginning of primordial stone tools, but we're seeing it at such a rapid pace in the recent digital revolution that we're in some ways being beholden to this evolution of technology that is wrenching us out of our own established ways of being.
Do you believe there's an inner drive to technology that is somehow independent of our own human agency? Because this now becomes a philosophical issue of extreme importance, because there are some who do believe that technology has its own inner sort of momentum and that it wants something that maybe is not in our best interest, but that it's driven, almost like could be a mindless Schopenhauerian kind of will, but that we do not master whatever that drive in technology is.
I think there's an element of that. I would not want to put intentionality into the equation there, but I do feel like following philosophers like the French philosopher of technology, Gilbert Simondon, he really makes a strong case for the fact that technologies do evolve in their own terms. There's a kind of logic to technical development. A spear will get more accurate, gas engine will become more efficient, and these things are not human logics, but logics of technology themselves. And I think one of the things that's important today is to think about how the evolution of technology can actually diminish or subjugate the human mind to its evolutionary demands rather than the other way around.
Right, right. The title of your book is An Artificial History of Natural Intelligence. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about how you understand natural and whether intelligence, this is a question that I keep pondering myself, which I don't have an answer to, whether intelligence has an independent kind of reality of its own from the human mind. But if that's the case, then what would we mean by natural, or what do you mean by natural intelligence?
Well, I think that's a complex term that could mean a number of different things. And one of the things that I did with the title is to try and play on that complexity. We could imagine a natural history of intelligence, and there's books with that title. Tom Stonier, for example, has a book with a title along that line. And this would play into, you know, dominant thinking in the fields of evolutionary psychology and related domains. But that particular thinking about natural intelligence as coming from our biological determination can never make sense of what we might call this break into culture and historicity.
Right, the errancy.
The errancy that takes us out of nature and into the world of culture and history. So I think that what we mean by natural intelligence to a human is what's endemic to the human is natural. But at that moment of the break, it is fundamentally a wrenching that takes place through the medium of artificial technologies. In other words, it's the capacity to invent a non-necessary contingent organization that provides a new foundation for life for the human.
Yeah.
It's not just a supplement to nature, it's actually a new form of life. So I do think that we have a form of natural intelligence after the break, but that form of intelligence is essentially the capacity for technicity.
And I gather from the section that you have on Heidegger in your book that what you're just describing there is what Heidegger calls world, that a world is not a natural phenomenon. It is always something that is constructed. As Hannah Arendt said, it involves labor, it involves work and action. And therefore, our tools and our technical intelligence is world-forming, the way that Heidegger distinguishes between human being and animal being, where animals are poor in world, as he puts it, whereas we are rich in world, and that we're not only rich in world, we also form worlds. And therefore, we have a reliance on what we could call technology or tools, equipment, in order to keep our worlds in being. And that makes it very difficult for me to understand why Heidegger was so concerned about the way in which modern technology seems to be the culminating phenomenon of nihilism, of Western nihilism, that is kind of right. Like a denial of being. Because you've convinced me that, no, if you take a Heideggerian understanding of Dasein as something that breaks from the natural order of being into the open-endedness of self-transcendence, finite transcendence, let's say, and openness to the world, that yes, it comes concomitant with technology.
Exactly. So the book is definitely very much influenced by Heidegger. And I think if you reread Being in Time, you can really see like everything that you said is true, that equipment and technology is something that dominates that book. So the question then is really the question of distinguishing between the human as a kind of technical creature who forms worlds with other people, because through technology, we're always exteriorizing our thinking into material forms that can be interiorized by other individuals. This is something that constitutes the social world. And I think that you're right to bring in Arendt there on that point as well. What we have to distinguish then is a kind of pathological condition from what we might take to be the condition of technicity per se that defines the human. And I think for Heidegger, the pathology was really the industrialization of technology, the move towards homogenization of repetition and automaticity within the realm of technology that would, as you said, diminish this capacity for human errancy, for human novelty, for this disruption that marks the human mind as a kind of intelligent entity. So I think that for Heidegger in The Question Concerning Technology from 1950, what he's really arguing is it's the industrialization of technology leads to a kind of industrialization of reason, where everything is understood to be fungible, everything is understood to be conditioned by means, ends, ways of thinking.
Production, consumption.
Production and consumption, exactly. And there's never any kind of truth in itself of the technical object or the human mind.
Is there another kind of thinking that is not always productive or inventive and world-forming, but is receptive, where it's a more of a kind of listening rather than talking, speaking analogically, kind of poetic thought, which receives the intimations of being and allows beings, the being of beings, to kind of come into
right.
the realm of appearance and accessibility to us. And that maybe Heidegger, in a lot of his later work, was about the difference between calculative thinking or the kind of thinking that culminates in cybernetics versus a kind of poetic thought.
Right, and cybernetics for him was the end of philosophy, the end of
yes.
thinking.
Yeah.
I think sometimes people criticize the late Heidegger for being overly mystical, looking to the origins of language as a kind of way of coming into contact with this primordial being. But I think what's really important about Heidegger's later work is this idea of clearing, is that the errancy is what can take us into spaces of clearing, the way of escaping the norms and demands of especially an industrialized, hypermodern culture, to spaces where we could be capable, as you said, of listening or of seeing intimations of something beyond. And that does sound mystical, but I think that there's ways of rethinking that in the 21st century when we think about how our brain is so dominated by sociocultural, technical, political systems of organization that have just been amplified by the digital revolution to the point where our nervous systems are really being trained by our technologies. The idea of a space of clearing in our own brains, our own minds, seems to be extremely important for that possibility of listening to something that is beyond who we are. And I take that as a really serious, serious question. How in the digital age in particular are we able to create this kind of Heideggerian space of clearing, which is not simply giving up our iPads or iPhones for 10 minutes during the day, but a much deeper question of how to, what Bernard Stiegler, a French philosopher, calls disautomatizing. How do we make the effort to disautomatize and therefore be open to something radically indeterminate?
What does he mean by disautomatize?
Well, I mean, Bernard Stiegler was very much influenced by Heidegger as well, and he argues that both at the origin of the human and also in terms of the industrial kind of amplification of technology, the human mind is a plastic entity that is trained to become automatic. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. He gives the example of the accomplished piano player who must learn to create automatisms so that you can then become a creative and disciplined performer. But the problem with industrialization of memory, industrialization of culture, is that our brains are trained to become automatic according to the logic of capitalism. That the technologies are imposing their logic on the human mind and creating automatisms. So it's important in that context to recognize that the brain and the mind depend on automatic behaviors. But we also need to learn how to disautomatize in order to extricate ourselves from the overwhelming dominant logics of capitalism in particular and the digital infrastructure.
So do you believe that digital technology in particular is predicated on a highly impoverished concept of what the mind is or what intelligence is, and that therefore it is also a forgetting of the errancy that underlies the whole human way of being in the world, and that is, in that sense, seeking to create an artificial zone of comfort for us?
Absolutely. I think in two ways that's an important point. The first is that this historical attempt to create an imitation or a simulation or a new version of a human mind through artificial intelligence constantly fails because it constantly fails to acknowledge what I would consider to be this fundamental character of the human mind, its fundamental errancy, its fundamental capacity for self-disruption and for failure and for productive invention. So that's one side of the equation. The other side is that this impoverished notion of intelligence that we now have with contemporary artificial intelligence that's based in machine learning in particular, also actively seeks to distract us and to form new kinds of connections in our brains that are not intelligent, that are actually predicated on a completely different logic, and one that is through, again, a digital infrastructure that is so well coordinated and reticulated through networks of organization, is constantly attacking our brain, you might say, attacking our brain and imposing its logic. So we have a sort of deformed notion of intelligence that is actually making us stupid.
Yes, indeed. That's my suspicion, is that the more efficient artificial intelligence becomes, the more stupid we get. And here you use the word distracting. So one could put that word distract in correlation with abstraction. If you understand abstraction in the most etymological sense of abstrade, which means to pull away, pull something away out of and draw it away from something, you could say that abstraction could be another word for errancy. And what I'm trying to say is that we've been, you know, pulled out of nature. We have been yanked out of it, and we're kind of in nature and out of it at the same time. This is the errancy. We miss the mark. Distraction is different from abstraction in that it is this constant sort of technology of forgetting where our true, the center of gravity of our being actually lies, which doesn't have a center. It's exocentric, if you want to say it.
Exactly. That's what Helmut Plessner said, exactly that the human is eccentric.
Eccentric.
Yeah.
Right.
In a literal sense. I would completely agree with that idea, and I would call attention to another word that has a similar etymology, which is abduction, the form of reasoning that is to lead you away from something to something radically novel. Yeah. And abduction is a form of reasoning that is radically different from deduction and induction, which is the normal logical categories. And I take this from Charles Sanders Peirce, this idea of abduction as being completely hypothetical, completely an anticipation of something that has no precedent. And I think you're right. It takes us away from the norms in order to resolve a problem that is radically novel or unprecedented.
Yeah. So I want to quote from your book again on this very issue. I also want to mention, since we're still talking here about errancy and error, that you did write a book called Enlightenment Aberrations. And the subtitle is something about the role of error. I don't have the subtitle.
Error and Revolution in France.
Error and Revolution in France, yes. Okay. Now we go back to the what you were just bringing up. And here you have, it's your very last paragraph in the book from what I can tell. But it says, what escapes the machine, even the computer, even networks of computers, even the human mind in its automatic phases, is this capacity to escape from its own determination. As Stigler wrote, human thought has, quote, the power to disrupt and to disautomize, that is to say, change the rules, only by leaving its own normative existence through shock and decision can a new norm ever be created as a function of a novel future that is imagined collectively and not merely predicted. And here, that last word, predicted, of course, prediction is part of what machine learning is always striving for, to get more and more accurate predictions. But you make a very interesting distinction between prediction in that technical sense and the existential disposition of anticipation. So it's two different ways of relating to the future.
Exactly.
Or maybe one doesn't relate to the future except as, you know, something predetermined. And this idea that our human way of being is, it's not that it's indeterminate, it has many determinations, but it can always change the norms and the conditions of its determination, and therefore it is capable of, again, we're getting Arendtian here, natality, novelty. Something new, unprecedented, can actually erupt in the midst of these determinations.
Right, and one way to think about that is to say, in order to be determined historically, which is to say contingently and in an open way, not determined by biology, that indeterminateness, which we could also call a certain kind of plasticity, is required for us to become determined. We must become automatic. But there's always some sort of residue, you might say, of that fundamental plasticity that allows us to break free, to interrupt, to disrupt, to go beyond. And I think that that's one of the concepts that really runs through the book. Strangely enough, it runs through even the history of artificial intelligence. Going back to Alan Turing, there's some very interesting clues in his work that he knew that to be intelligent was to deviate from norms, to deviate from programming. And he was constantly trying to kind of conceive of a computer that would be capable of not computing properly.
In fact, deviation is connected to errancy and to error, and they both refer to a Greek word, hamartia. Hamartia is a very interesting word in Greek. It's the word that Aristotle used, badly translated as tragic flaw of a character. But hamartia originally meant to miss the mark, like an arrow that deviates from the straight path. And it's strangely the word which in the Vulgate Bible is translated as peccatum, sin, and that therefore original sin, in a strange way, understands our condition as deviant, as having missed the mark, as errant. And error, and of course, then Christianity tries to set out a roadmap of how we can get back home to God from where we have strayed away from it. But this idea of hamartia as missing the mark, deviation, this is really the kind of reality that we live in. And here, a question about norms for you, David, because there's so much obsession among, especially theorists and philosophers, about normativity. And it's one of the buzzwords, especially in academia, especially in Europe. If you go, Germans, for example, can't give a talk in Germany without someone always coming back to about normativity and what is the obsession with providing norms, credible norms, either for behavior or ideology or even in philosophy, is that because there's so much anxiety about the fact that our norms are contingent and can always be renewed or cast anew? Because there is a nostalgia or a longing for some kind of containment within a stable set of norms, which is not an illegitimate sort of longing, because it's difficult to continue existing within this radical indeterminacy of a condition without any norms.
We can't live in a chaos. I think that's right. And I think Heidegger, you know, gives us some direction here as well, is that we have this sort of radical recognition that we're not defined by who we actually are concretely historically. And yet we need those historical norms, those social conditions to provide security. And quite literally at the biological level, the human is a creature that needs historically contingent norms in order to survive in nature. We are the creature that produces life artificially. But you're right that there's a kind of emphasis on normativity that tries to distinguish norms and also to kind of justify them through processes of philosophical deliberation, as though there can be norms that would be universal. And I think that that's still behind this kind of, like you say, a longing for normativity. I'm very much influenced by the controversial German legal thinker, Carl Schmitt, who wanted to say, well, what's really important is the exception to the norm, not the norm itself, because the exception reveals the contingency of norms. But I would push that one step further and say, like with Heidegger as well, the moment of recognizing that the norms are no longer operating, or that they're failing, or that they no longer do the work that they need to do, is a moment for decision.
Yes.
Yeah. And decision is what creates the new norm. Decision is what allows us to construct a new world. It's the fear of that openness that I think sometimes allows us to cling to norms that are no longer viable. And I think we're seeing that in the digital revolution. We're clinging to norms that are in some ways peculiar to an epoch that has already passed. And we're in a moment when we really need to decide for the future in a way that simply isn't going back to these past norms and concepts.
So which past norms do you see in play in the technology?
Well, one of them would be in political theory. I think that we're still kind of like locked into a certain concepts of the state, certain concepts of the individual, certain concepts of freedom, international law that don't in some ways come to be able to kind of grasp what's happening in a networked, internationally organized digital world. It's at a planetary scale, and yet we don't have concepts to understand how politics is played out through technology. So I think that's one of the domains that I'm particularly interested in.
Yeah. That means that we have to think even more thoughtfully about technology in order to come to a deeper understanding of how to respond to the very essence of technicity. And when you talk about decision, you have that discourse about decision where you say that the mind is always the site of crisis, of the unexpected, of the event, and that is why the human mind is capable of genuine decision in crisis. Now, crisis, we know, is already has the concept of decision in it. Decision means to be separated from, and that we are always in a state of crisis because we are not self-coincident. We never were, never will be. But decision also can demand being resolute. You have to actually decide. If you're in the midst of a civil war and you're Lincoln, you say, well, here we are on this battlefield, and we have to decide, is our union going to persist or is it not going to persist? And that you it calls for a commitment sometimes, existentially, historically, and so forth. So do you believe that while the mind is always in this state of crisis, that makes commitment to certain decisions all the more imperative?
It does, especially, as you say, in moments of crisis where we really come to face that challenge of the indeterminate or the contingency of life. And this is where I would come back to the notion of anticipation, is the decision is always in anticipation of a future to come that has not yet happened.
Right.
And this is where we get a fundamental opposition to the machine learning paradigm, which is to predict the future based on what's happened in the past. There couldn't be anything more different than that. And this is where anticipation is a particularly human. We commit to a future that's imagined that has never been in existence before.
Well, there I think we have to be careful about going too far in that direction. Why? Because if you think of the French Revolution, you've written about the French Revolution, but this idea that you can project a whole new future and politics and ideology and just pretend as if the past doesn't have these continuing claims upon the present and the future, then you may end up having a kind of crash and burn project of a revolution. If we go back to the Gettysburg moment where Lincoln is reminding the nation that they're in a moment of crisis and of decision and that they have to go forward in a new way, this new nation on this continent, he is also invoking the fathers who brought forth 67 years ago. So there's a past that the future has to be in relation to. And I think you agree with me from what I've read about your theories about what it means to be historical, that to be historical means to put the past and the present into relation with one another. And so it's not just a brave new world to come that is completely detached and severed from the past.
Right. I think that's what maybe makes the American experiment of the Civil War quite different from the French case, because the French case, the idea was that the norms of the historical past were completely and utterly irrelevant in a modern day. And so there was in some ways the decision to start, as you said, from scratch, which was sort of pushed on the French by the long persistence of feudalism in a modern country. Whereas the Americans had come, as Arendt said, to a kind of a new space, had established a new republic. But still, I think we can think of them in the same way, is that you're right. There was a decision made to persist in that historical trajectory. Mm-hmm. A different decision could be made at that moment, but the decision was to persist, and Lincoln's dictatorship was, in essence, an effort to continue that path. The French case is very complicated. I don't want to go into the details of the French Revolution, but I would say that we don't want to, as you say, we rightly want to be careful of destroying norms because they provide security.
Well, also because when you write the past off as mere superstition and ignorance, then somehow your future doesn't have any kind of basis for its continuation. Of course, we did a show recently on Giambattista Vico where the past is never past. I mean, it's always has this, it agitates in the present and it can be called on from the future. I guess this is also Heideggerian about this retrieval, Wiederholung, where there's a certain kind of mysterious transmission that takes place. But anyway, that might take us a little bit off topic, because in the time that remains, I'd like to ask you, the people involved in the actual making of the digital technologies that go into machine learning, ChatGPT and so forth, what lesson would you like them to derive from your book if they were to read it and take it as seriously as it deserves to be taken?
Well, I think this notion that we've been kind of circling around errancy, there's a number of associated concepts that are fundamentally about breaking, about discontinuity. And I think that to try and imagine intelligence as radically discontinuous, something that opens up novelty, like as you said with Arendt, sort of the possibility of natality, this requires actually deep philosophical work, and I also think historical work, to think about what that means in light of contemporary neuroscience, contemporary artificial intelligence, and the way that the mind is being staged in the 21st century. So that's what I would like people to take away from the book, is that we are not at home in ourselves, but that is also a kind of moment of a more radical freedom that is simply not conceptualized within contemporary artificial intelligence paradigms.
Well, that's good enough for me. David Bates, professor of rhetoric at UC Berkeley. It's been a pleasure to have you on Entitled Opinions. And this discourse is not going to go away anytime soon. So I hope you'll come back and continue the conversation with us.
Thank you so much. It was great to be here.
I'm Robert Harrison for Entitled Opinions. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.